I think that oftentimes we can get so caught up in our petty little lives that we forget what's really important. And sometimes we can become so spoiled in the blessings of God that we actually become indifferent to the blessings that He gives. And tonight, what we're going to get into is a husband and a wife. They're now married. And the way their marriage started, you would think that everything would be fantastic. We're always told stories as kids like Cinderella. And how do all those stories end? What's the conclusion to stories like Cinderella? They live happily ever after. And so we grow up believing those stories. Then we get married. And we realize we were lied to. That the most magnificent person we ever met leaves the lid up. Or doesn't put the cap back on the milk. Or doesn't wash dishes. Or doesn't do anything other than watch TV and sit on the couch. And pretty soon it's difficult to realize where the couch ends and they begin. And what we're getting into tonight really is something very significant, that some of us get into marriage, or some of us who are single are looking forward to marriage, and really the picture in our mind is one that's a fairy tale. It's not one that's reality. The whole issue of sacrifice, the thing that we've already hit to a certain degree, the whole issue of giving of oneself and practicing Philippians 2, of considering another higher than ourselves and serving for their well-being, is really the heart and key to all passion, whether it be with God, with husband or wife, with missions, ministry, labor, whatever it might be. That sacrifice is the key to passion. And what we're going to see tonight is that much of the passion is already starting to diminish from this very young marriage, because much of the sacrifice has been forgotten. Listen to this. The woman starts off by saying, Abishag says, I slept, but my heart was awake. She's sort of in this half-conscious state. Have you ever been that place in the morning where you're kind of awake, but you're still asleep, and you're somewhere in that semi-conscious state between those two? So it's hard to know exactly what's really going on and what's just a dream. She's in that place. And so most commentators say that this is a dream that she had. I think it may also be an actual occurrence. But in either event, it begins by telling us that she's in this semi-conscious state, and this is what she's thinking. And she says, I slept, but my heart was awake. And you need to know in the Hebrew, particularly as we're studying the wisdom literature, it's very essential to know what the heart is. The heart is the center of the mind and the will and the emotions. It's the total person. It's not just the feelings. The Lord incorporates that. It's much more than that. And she says, listen, my lover is knocking. And here's what he says. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my love, my flawless one. And so as we've already studied, Solomon most likely would have made an entirely separate bridal chamber for his wife. And in this entire palace, she would have had her own sort of independent, almost apartment, I guess you could say, her own private dwelling place that they could be alone together and she could get some privacy. And so Solomon comes and he knocks on the door and he's looking for his wife because he wants to be with her intimately. He goes on and he says, my head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. So as you say, have you ever been camping and early in the morning your tent is just soaking wet and you're soaking wet? It's probably about that time of the morning for his head to be drenched with dew and for him to be wet. It's just very, very damp. It's very late night or very early evening, very early morning rather. And so what we've got here is that Solomon has been working for how long? If he's just getting home. All night. This is the newlywed wife's nightmare. A husband who's addicted to his job. Solomon's out working all night. And we don't know what he was doing. We don't know if it was something that was valid. And, you know, he is the king of Israel. Maybe something important came up. He may have a very valid reason. Or maybe he was just too busy and he was starting to already neglect his wife and go back to worshiping his job and pouring all of his time into his labors. Either way, it's a familiar story. And so here's how she responds to him. Now up to this point, how has she responded to him? Has she been inviting sexually? Has she been warm? Has she encouraged him to pursue her? Once they're married, is she looking forward to making herself available and being intimate with her husband? Absolutely. Absolutely. And now they're married, and he comes to be with her. Here's what she says. I have taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I have washed my feet. Must I soil them again? Does that sound like two good excuses to not get up and unlock the door so that your husband could come in and make love to you? One, oh, I have to put my robe on. Actually, when you make love, you take your robe off. So that's not a problem. What's the other one? My feet will get dirty. I don't think he cares about the bottom of her feet. If he does, we're talking about the Queen of Israel in her own private chamber. It's not like getting up and walking to the door will make her feet so dirty that she'd be just some absolutely ungracious woman that no one would want to touch, right? I mean, we're not talking about a major sacrifice, are we? She has this dream, and this is what she's thinking. The whole issue here is she willing to be inconvenienced to be with the person that she loves? Is she willing to make a sacrifice? Is she willing to wake up from a good night's sleep to participate with her husband? My lover thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. So what's Solomon doing? Is he just accepting the fact of these terrible excuses? No, he's trying to bust into her room. He's trying to find a way to pick the lock. He's now married, and he likes being married, and he wants to be married. And his wife is sleeping, and so, again, she's having this dream. She's sleeping. He wants in. She won't get up. She's giving him some bad excuses, so he's trying to find a way. The king of Israel, you got to look at this. The king of Israel is trying to pick the lock so he can get in to be with his own wife. She goes on to say, my heart had gone out for him when he spoke. I called for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. So by the time, either in reality or in her dream, she gets up to answer the door, Solomon's gone. He's left. He's waited around. He's tried to pick the lock. So far, he's unsuccessful. It's late night, early morning. He's tired. Who knows what he did? He may have went on, just showered up and went back to work, or maybe he just went somewhere else and got some sleep. Bottom line is this acceptable? Biblically, is this acceptable? In this case, it just happens to be Solomon. It oftentimes happens to the woman as well. I don't think it necessarily matters what gender it is. But biblically, is this acceptable? How do you think Solomon felt? Newly married guy, loves his wife. They've been talking about all the things they're going to do. He comes home to do them. He can't even pick the lock. Does this sound like and they lived happily ever after? No. We've got a lot of young married couples, and they could tell you this is the reality of marriage, that two selfish people enter into a covenant, and pretty soon they learn actually how to serve and to give. But it doesn't come naturally. It's something that has to be worked at. That when we get married, C.S. Lewis says we often go into it with this idea of need love. Boy, I got all these needs. I'm going to get married. This person's going to meet my needs. This is going to be great. And we find out that marriage is all about gift love, where we say, well, I'm going to get married. I'm just going to serve that person, irregardless of whether or not my needs get met, because if I serve them and they serve me, we'll both be satisfied. And we don't see that here. We see very much a need love. She has a need for sleep. He has a need to be with her. And so her need gets met. And you've got the king of Israel. Solomon's a guy that can have a lot of women. Solomon's a guy that lots of people would have gotten up and opened the door for. Sitting there, and I think to be honest with you, particularly ladies, you need to realize that this is a good way to kill a guy. This is a good way to completely deflate. I think there's a difference between dignity and pride, but I think this is a good way to remove dignity. Same thing for a gentleman. If your wife comes pursuing you and wants to be intimate with you, and you won't even settle any sort of inconvenience to serve her. Not just that love and sexuality is just service, but there are times where maybe we don't feel like serving, but we need to serve. And that includes sexuality, it includes taking out the garbage, it includes mowing the lawn, it includes lots of things that are all acts of love and intimacy. And I was meditating on this, and it's pure speculation on my behalf. There's no justification for it, so I'll confess that at the front end. But as we're studying the book, and I see how much they love each other, how committed they are to each other, and then we see at the end of his life, he's picked up an additional 700 wives and 300 girlfriends. I would have to say at some point, the train jumped the tracks. You know what I'm saying? Something happened. Something really happened here. It's like, oh my gosh, honey, I've been unfaithful. Well, how bad is it? It's really bad. You know? I was curious. I'm wondering if perchance this wasn't something that they continued to struggle with, that he was busy with his work and she didn't want to be inconvenienced. And so over time, he worshiped his job and she became lazy or indifferent. And there's nothing worse than an indifferent spouse. And I wonder if perchance Solomon didn't go out and get his desires satisfied elsewhere. In doing so, it was sin, not abdicating him for his responsibility. But I'm saying this, that it doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman, that over time, if the person that you're married to feels neglected and unappreciated and undesirable, at some point, their desire for intimacy and romance and sexuality will just continue to diminish until you've robbed them of their dignity and there's no way that they're going to want to be intimate. So they go on. At this point, she's up and she's looking for him. She's chasing him now. She realizes what's happened. Okay. She says, the watchmen found me, and as they made their rounds in the city, they beat me, they bruised me, and they took away my cloak. Those watchmen of the walls. Again, here it seems like this is most likely a dream. I can't see a scenario where the queen of Israel is out roaming the streets, and so the policemen grab her, beat her, strip her half naked, and send her out into the night. If so, that would become very much a part-time job for those guys. And so I think possibly here, the reason in her dream that she has this negative experience whereby she's actually being beaten and degraded is, I think, possibly it's just the result of her guilty conscience. She's feeling bad, and so she imposes some sort of punishment on herself in her dream. And she goes on to say, O daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my lover, that will you tell him that I am faint with love? And so she now feels guilty. She feels bad because she's rejected her husband. And so she tells her friends, if you see Solomon, tell him that I do love him. And where she says here, I'm faint with love, the issue there is a reference to lovemaking, that she really desires to be with him sexually. She desires to be intimate with him. And if anyone sees him, to tell him that. There's almost this sense of desperation that once she's kicked him out, well, she recognizes what she's done and she's in deep remorse and regret. And so then her friends jump in. How is your beloved better than others, most beautiful of women? How is your beloved better than others that you so charge us? And so her friends are asking here, well, if you're telling us that Solomon is such a wonderful guy, and you know how it is when a couple gets engaged, right, ladies? A young woman gets engaged. For the next few months, what do you hear about? Every day. Every minute of every day, what does the conversation center on? Her fiancé, right? She tells you what he eats and what he wears, and she tells you everything that you never wanted to know about this guy that she's going to marry. Same thing with a guy. He finds a woman he falls in love with, they get engaged, that's all he talks about. And so they boast at each other, they brag at each other. Solomon and Abishag have been doing the same thing. And now, he comes to be with her, and she kicks him out. And so her friends are asking her, well, are you sure this guy's great? And if he's so great, why is he so great? You've been telling us for a long time that he's the most wonderful man you've ever met. And now you guys have got friction in your relationship. What's the problem? And I think in so doing, what they're asking her to do is to look back to their original conversations and to look back on the reasons that she admired him and to remind her of why she married the guy in the first place. Go back and meditate on the things that drew you to him. And so she does. She starts here to speak about Solomon in a very positive way. And what you need to understand, too, is that this is very rare. Oftentimes in ancient Near Eastern poetry, there's a lot of songs and there's a lot of very graphic physical descriptions regarding women, but there's very few in regards to men. There's very few occasions where a woman writes anything that is sexually graphic or explicit about a male. And here we see Abishag doing this about her husband. She starts to recall why it is that she loves him. She starts to recall why it is she entered this covenant with him, why she's decided to marry him. And so she starts to speak about that. And here's what she says. My lover is ruddy and radiant, outstanding among 10,000. And to say that he's radiant is just to say that he's a good-looking guy. And ruddy means he's got just a good complexion. He's a good-looking guy. His head is purest gold. His hair is wavy, black as a raven. Saying that his head is purest gold, it's not that it's soft, though it could be. Some gentlemen have that as well. Saying that it's made of the most finest elements, that is, his head is pure gold. It's something that's precious, and it's a treasure, and she loves to look at him. His hair is wavy and black as a raven, and so Solomon has got jet black hair, and it's wavy, so probably it's fairly long. Maybe he plays guitar. She goes on. She starts at the top, and she works her way down, and you'll see with him later on, he works at the bottom, and very quickly moves his way north. We'll get to that later, though. His eyes are like doves by the water streams, washed in milk, mounted like jewels. And so she's echoing what he had said earlier, that his eyes are doves. And as we studied, doves are always a symbol of purity, of passion, and a dove has one committed mate throughout the course of its lifetime. And so in saying that his eyes are doves, she's saying that they are focused on him, on her alone, that he is devoted to her, and that there's purity and there's passion and there's something very sacred in the way that he looks at her and in the way that he perceives her. And when she says here that his eyes are like doves by the water streams, washed in jewels, washed in milk, mounted like jewels, the issue is that the outer rim of his eye is just white, and that the iris set in the eye itself is like a mounted jewel. He's got great eyes, and she's obviously spent a great deal of time just looking into his eyes. His cheeks are beds of spice yielding perfume, and there was a common custom in that culture for a man to perfume his beard. And so when she says that his cheeks have the sweet fragrance, he smells well. He knows how to care for himself. And again, gentlemen, you wouldn't believe this, but the way that you smell is a spiritual issue. And he has put some cologne on, and he smells very nice. He doesn't smell like he normally smells when he's with the rest of the guys. And that's something good to remember. His lips are like lilies dripping with myrrh. And here, she likes the taste of his mouth. And you get the picture that he's probably chewing some herbs that give him fresh breath. He's used mouthwash. And married women will tell you that over time, these things make a difference. They make a big difference. His arms are rods of gold set with chrysolite. And so she talks about the fact that his arms are strong. He's in good shape. Physically, he's secure. You almost get the picture that when he holds her, she feels warm and she feels safe, that he has strength. And that his hands are very soft. They're like gold. So when he handles her passionately. He handles her in a very soft, tender way, but he's also very strong, and she finds security in his presence. His body is like polished ivory decorated with sapphires. And so here she begins to talk about his body, and I think she's got a picture of him being undressed. And she's essentially saying here that his skin is smooth, and that physically he's kept himself in good shape. That he's done a good job of preserving his appearance out of love for his wife, so that when he undresses in front of her, she likes what she sees. And so, here's what your pastor did this week. Why is everybody laughing? You don't think I'm going to confess it? Well, I'm not going to confess anything then. That's it. No more confession. No, but as you get married, what tends to happen, can happen, not all men do this, but that sometimes a gentleman could start to take his wife for granted. Okay? That you don't exercise, you don't watch what you eat, you don't get your hair cut all the time, you don't brush your teeth, you don't use mouthwash, you don't put on cologne, all these things that she's talking about that she appreciates in him. So I'd encourage a gentleman, start taking inventory. Am I doing the same things that I did to get my wife? Am I doing the same things to continue courting her? Because courtship doesn't end when you say I do. It just takes on another dimension. The courtship continues. And if you're single, remember this, that your marriage is not a finish line, it's a starting line. And you need to get into good habits of preparing yourself to be a good spouse in every way. And those things continue into your marriage. So, what I've done is I've totally changed my diet. Because I was eating junk food, always on the run, not sleeping well. So now, I don't know, I feel like some sort of leftist or something. I'm eating trace minerals and vitamins, and I'm not drinking any caffeine for the month of November, and I'm not eating any fast food, and I'm going to watch my diet, and I'm going to try and get myself in better health so I can take care of myself for the sake of my wife and also for the sake of our daughter. Why? Because that's important to me. That's important to her. That's important to me as well. And so I would encourage you gentlemen, if none of the clothes that fit you when you got married, if that's the case, if everything you wore when you got married is now a distant memory, you may want to reconsider practically for God and for your spouse, bringing life under control and living in a disciplined way so that you can still be attractive to your mate. I'm not saying that you have to be addicted to worshiping your physical body and you need to be overly concerned. But I think there's a point of just respect and of grace and of caring for your spouse and presenting yourself in such a way that they continue to find you attractive. And I think that's biblical. And so she goes on. His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of pure gold. Solomon's like, he's a fullback. He's got good bottom center of gravity. He's got strong legs. He's muscular. He stands secure and firm. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as its cedars. And Lebanon was known for its fertility, its great beauty, and it had the tallest cedars in the entire region. So in saying that his appearance is like Lebanon, choice as its cedars, she's saying sort of that he stands out among the rest of the men, that he is beautiful, and that he is a treasure, and that he is very unique, and she finds him to be something very precious. And so he goes on, his mouth is sweetness itself. He is altogether lovely. And here she's speaking not just about his physical mouth, but about his speech. She's saying that the way that he speaks to her is sweetness itself. And so again, we'll see this over and over and over in the book, that the key, or I should say one of the keys to a good relationship is communication and words that are carefully chosen and are sweet. And he knows how to speak to her. He speaks to her honestly, he speaks to her passionately, but he speaks to her graciously. He's kind to her. He selects his words very carefully. And in so doing, she really appreciates the concern and the care he has as he speaks to her, that it's a sacred activity when you speak to someone you love, and the words that you choose are very important. And she really appreciates the fact that he is so careful in how he speaks to her. He's tender, he's warm, he's affectionate. He's a gentleman. She goes on and she concludes by saying, this is my lover, this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. And so she's saying here to these women, this is why I like him so much. This is why he is so great. He is my lover, in summary, and he is my friend. He is my sexual partner, and I can be erotic with him. He is also my friend. I can go for a walk in the park and hold his hand and talk about my day. He can do both of those things for me. He is my lover, and he is my friend. We can be passionate, and we can also be playful. That he meets more than just one dimension of her needs, and that's why she loves him. So her friends jump back in. Where has your lover gone, most beautiful of women? Which way did your lover turn, that we may look for him with you? And so now her friends are like, okay, we'll help you find him. And what you'll find, friends, is this, is that if you know a married couple, and they get into an argument or a squabble, what may happen is that they come to you looking for help. What do her friends do to seek to help to restore this breaking in a relationship? What do? Their entire effort is to seek to bring the couple back together so they can sit down and talk. The whole book is built on conversation between the husband and the wife. This is the first time that we have long segment of conversation in the entire book that they're not having together. She's talking to her girlfriends. She should be talking to her husband. It's a good thing that she speaks well of her husband, but the bottom line is, they won't fix their scenario until they sit down and talk to one another. And so for the first time in the book, major conversation segment doesn't include the two of them. And so the key to the restoring of the relationship is to get the two of them back together so they can sit down and have the same kind of honest, heartfelt, intimate, gracious conversation that they had to launch their marriage. Okay? And so know this, that one of the best things that you can do if you have friends that are married and are struggling or are arguing or are not getting along is to encourage them to be together and to sit down and to talk and to speak in such a way that their speech is sweetness altogether itself, just like she says. And so she says this, "My lover has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to browse in the gardens and to gather lilies." I think in a very poetic way, she's saying that Solomon is working. He is very busy. He's got a great deal to do. We see in Genesis 1 and 2 that men and women were created in the image and likeness of God. In chapter 3, they sin, and the curse that is placed on the man is that he will have to labor very difficultly to provide for his family. That work will now become a tremendous burden and a difficulty. And so women, you need to know, especially women that are single, when you choose a husband, you're also selecting his vocation to be part of your life. And that is a burden that is on his shoulder. It's a curse from God, and it's very difficult. And so gentlemen, you also need to know this, that curse is something that God has asked you to bear. You need to work hard. Paul says in the New Testament, if a man doesn't work, he doesn't eat. And so labor is of God, and work was given before sin entered the world, but at the same time, it can't become such an over-consuming thing that we neglect all the other dimensions of our life. In this case, we get the appearance that Solomon is busy, and possibly for good reason, but at the same time, his wife is feeling totally neglected and left out. She's not getting quality time, she's not getting time for conversation, she is getting the leftover time, and he is sneaking in the middle of the night and trying to pick the lock so he can get sex. A lot of women feel like that. But the courting has ended, and now the routine is set in. And so the solution seems to be here, time together, and particularly time in conversation. Time to talk. How are we doing? You know, one thing I would encourage the couples, Grace and I always encourage it, is we've had a date night for 7 or 8 years now, ever since we were dating before we were married. And every Friday night, we go out. We do something. We go out to a movie, we go out to a play, we go out to a concert, we go out to dinner. Sometimes we just stay home and sit on the couch and turn on all the lights and unplug the phone and try to hide from all of you. Right? And we love the church and we love the people, but the bottom line is I love my wife a lot more. And I love to be with her. I don't mind working, I don't mind doing ministry, but the bottom line is we need some hours during the week that we can just sit down, be husband and wife, talk, see how we're doing, communicate, continue to build a relationship, and be together. Because work will always continue to stack up. And there's never, ever going to be a day where I'm going to get caught up, or any man's going to get caught up. And so, I think the issue here is she's saying, he's really busy, he's working. I am my lover, she says, and my lover is mine. He browses among the lilies. In chapter 2, verse 16, the order was reversed here. She said, he is mine and I am his. Here she says, I am his and he is mine. She initiates the reconciliation by saying, you know, I belong to him. I belong to him. And I think in a large part that means I belong to his entire life. So I'm going to rededicate myself. I'm going to commit myself to him. And just like we studied in 1 Corinthians 7 and Ephesians 5:21, this issue of mutual ownership, mutual submission, that these folks are partners and they're in this thing together, and she has rededicated her love to him. She's communicated that I am his, I belong to him, and he is mine, he belongs to me. And that's really the solution. Not to live parallel lives. He is his own person, I am my own person. But together, he is mine, I am his. We belong to each other, we're one. We're one person. There's one identity there. Then the man, here's Solomon, he comes back in. He's probably fixed his wounds. He's got his dented ego back in shape. And the question now becomes, gentlemen, how would you speak to a woman that has just done this to you? You are the king of Israel. Thousands of young women want to marry you. Everybody is interested in you. Everybody does what you say at the drop of a hat. You always get your way. You're the boss. You come home, you can't even get into your wife's bedroom. Your wife then recognizes that she was wrong, that she does love you, and she regrets what she's done. and she comes to you to confess that. How do you respond? How do you respond? If you're not married, how are you going to respond? This is very important. I told you so. Oh, honey, it's not half as bad as you think. You think you're bad? You're terrible. How does he respond? You are beautiful, my darling. That's sweet. He doesn't lord it over. He doesn't abuse her. He isn't ungracious or unkind to her. She says, you are beautiful, my darling. You're beautiful. As Tisra, lovely as Jerusalem, majestic as troops with banners. Tisra is a place of great beauty. It was from the region sort of where Abishag lived. She would have known that. It's a beautiful city. He's just telling her, honey, you are still beautiful to me. Maybe things aren't perfect. I'm still committed to you. You're still committed to me. I find you attractive. Nothing has changed. Everything is the same that it was. Turn your eyes from me. They overwhelm me. He's saying, you know, just to look into your eyes makes everything okay. Just seeing you, looking into your face, seeing that there's love and there's forgiveness and that there's compassion and that there's commitment in your eyes, that just completely overwhelms me. He can barely stand it. And so he goes on really quickly in conclusion, and he speaks back to her, and he tells her all of the reasons that he's attracted to her. And it's the same list that we studied on their wedding night last week. The only difference is that there are two omissions here that he had on their wedding night that he doesn't say here. One is a reference to her lips and to her kissing. The other is a reference to her breasts. Now, why do you think in this case he wouldn't speak about those elements that he finds attractive in her that are particularly sexual? Can you think of why? I think he wants her to know that his primary motivation for reconciling with her, of being in love with her, of forgiving her, of being in relationship together, is not for the sex. That sex is the result of that, but that's not the goal. That he loves her because he loves her, not because of the sex that she can give him. There's a lot of genius there, guys. Pay attention to that. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Gilead. We said a flock of goats running down a hill, jet black, would look like a wavy mane of hair. It's a beautiful picture. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep coming up from the washing. She has beautiful white teeth. Each one has its twin, not one of them alone. He loves the fact that she didn't play hockey and she has all of her teeth. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. And there, probably a better translation is her cheeks. He's saying that she's got rosy, red cheeks. She's got a beautiful complexion. He loves to look at her. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number, but my dove. Nicknames are so important. My perfect one. She's feeling better about herself already. Is unique, the only daughter of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. You are the only daughter of your mother, and you are her favorite child. All the way from birth, where your mother conceived you, up until now, everybody knows two things, honey. You are unique, and you are special. There's no one like you. And it's beautiful what he says. I don't think at this point in his life Solomon was polygamous. I don't think he'd gone out and gotten all of his wives and messed up his life yet. He's just saying here, 60 queens there may be. I think he's speaking just in general terms. There may be queens all over this world, sweetheart. And virgins everywhere that are waiting for someone to be with them. And innumerable concubines, basically glorified prostitutes, women who know how to have sex, women who know how to use their bodies, women who know how to satisfy and gratify a man. But what's he say? You are unique. You are the best. Even though things aren't as wonderful right now, honey, maybe we just came through our first fight. Maybe we're going through a trying phase. Maybe I need to figure out how to get my work under control, and you need to figure out how to serve sacrificially But the bottom line is, there is not a queen on this planet, there is not a virgin who is pure, and there is not a woman who knows what to do with her body that I would rather be with than you. You are unique, you are special, you are my wife. The maiden saw her and called her blessed. The queens and concubines praised her. You get the impression here, just like in Proverbs 31, that Solomon spoke well of his wife when he was apart from her. When other women would be in the area, or when other men would see him, he would speak very well of his wife in her absence. And so everyone else speaks well of her also. Question, if you're married, how do you speak of your spouse in the presence of others? Do you berate them? Do you talk about their negative qualities? Do you display your dirty laundry in public? Or do you speak in such a way that everybody recognizes that person through the eyes of God, through the forgiveness of Christ, and sees them as majestic and wonderful and beautiful and unique and special? Because how you speak about your spouse is the same way that everyone else will speak about your spouse. They will follow your lead. And we get the indication here that Solomon has spoken very well of his wife. He has honored her. 1 Peter 3 says that same thing. Husbands, honor your wives. And he has done that here. And so it closes. Who is this that appears like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, majestic as the stars and procession? Dear Heavenly Father, some of us are married and things are going really well. And for that we're grateful. And if perchance, dear Father, a difficult time would come, I pray that we would all learn to demonstrate a Christ-like attitude of forgiveness and service and humility, compassion and sacrifice. God, that passion comes at a cost. God, some of us here, and we're married, and some of the gentlemen are just like Solomon. They're working too many hours. They're too busy with the affairs of the world. There's too many things that they have obligated them to. They don't have time, good time, special time, to give to their wives. Their wives are feeling a little neglected, a little left out of the picture, possibly even just used for sex. God, I pray for those relationships. We pray that those couples would do the same thing as Solomon and Abishag. They would sit down and talk. And that any friends that may know people like that would encourage those couples just to get together and to sit down and to be honest and to chat. God, for those of us whom are single, I pray for the men that they would choose their vocations carefully. We pray that they would, even as they're single, start to get life under control, manageable, to be responsible, to be ready to have a life that a wife can enter into. And for the women, God, we pray for discernment that as they select a husband, that they would recognize that they are marrying not only him, but his entire world and his entire life. And I pray that they would walk into that with eyes open and with consciences clear and with much grace. So God, we bring ourselves before you tonight saying, admittedly, that we all are selfish and proud people, that we like to have things our way and we like to be served. God, we all pray that we'd be more like Christ, that through his forgiveness and his grace, we'd learn to give, not just receive, and that our relationships, both in marriage and in friendship and in family, would look like the gospel. We thank you for that possibility in Christ's name. Amen.